Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
Let's talk a bit about Rio Ferdinand, shall we? Because the story today is that he is being linked with the Manchester United director of football job, sporting director, technical director. Given that they haven't appointed it yet, it's hard to know exactly what that role will be. But it's fair to say it's a strategic football role at a boardroom level. Betrayed was the headline splashed across the back of the Daily Mail, who broke the story this morning. I think it actually referred to the Alex Hale statement, which we'll come on to later. But Manchester United fans might feel a bit betrayed if they end up with Rio Ferdinand as their director of football. Because the club have fallen behind on this. Of course, United need a director of football. It's so obvious. It's not a new concept. You know, for years, clubs have been doing this, appointing someone to take charge of their football strategy. It's funny, really, that there are a number of Premier League clubs looking around at the moment. Everton, Leicester, Liverpool, City, Watford and Wolves have all got people in that role. Brighton are bringing someone in, so they're quite settled. But some of the big clubs, Arsenal, Chelsea, Southampton as well, are still looking for someone to fulfil that role. And it means that United will have to face competition for people. Years ago, that wouldn't have been a problem, but now they find themselves having to think, well, not only who would be good at this, but who will come and do it? Rio Ferdinand, it appears, is on that shortlist. He does at least have a decent amount of experience in football, having won 6 league titles and a Champions League at United. Significantly more experience than, say, boxing, which he launched himself headlong into. Frankly, I think he's about as qualified for the director of football job as he was to become a professional boxer. The only advantage is that at least the British Boxing Board of Control denied him a licence. No one will be able to do that if Rio Ferdinand gets the job as sporting director or director of football. No one will be able to stop him if Ed Woodward is sufficiently convinced of his merits to bring him in as part of the upstairs staff. It's mad, really, because actually, since retiring, what has Ferdinand done that qualifies him for that job? I think very little. He spent 20 years as a professional footballer. Fine, that's obviously valid, and he was a very good player. I can't take that away from him. But it's not as though since he retired, he's spent time learning the other side of the coin, spending time in academies, understanding how the game works, understanding how footballers progress in the game. When he hung up his boots, his statement said he realised it was time to get back in the house and watch other people play the game. There was little consideration for remaining as an active part of the sport. He's been a regular pundit on BT, but that's about it. He's an active businessman. That's true. It's typical of Woodward's reign at Old Trafford that actually he was said to be most impressed by Ferdinand's clothing line and restaurant, which have been very successful. But it misses the entire point, actually, if you ask me, because Ferdinand would be an appointment that remains flawed. United will probably, if Ferdinand is the route they're going down, there's also been talk of Darren Fletcher and Paul Scholes, it would be another appointment of a club legend in an effort to appease a fan base who've had to watch United flounder in the modern football context. They've become increasingly frustrated by the fact that United have no clear strategy on the footballing side of things. Look at the different people they've appointed as manager, or the different signings that they've made. There is no cohesion to what they're trying to do there. All that's happening is they're just going on and off different ideas. One year they decide, oh, we're going to try and play attacking football. We're going to sign young players. All right, great, let's do that. And they went out and bought the best young talent they could. And then they brought in a different type of manager who was more pragmatic. Oh, no, we need experienced, more cynical players. If you compare them to the likes of Ajax, who will go into a Champions League semi-final tonight with a team full of homegrown talent, seeded with a couple of experienced players, playing a very clear system that they've stuck to for ages. When you compare United to Ajax and you say which club has a brighter future, it's Ajax. Because Ajax have got all those systems in place and have done for a number of years. So how United can still consider themselves part of the top echelon in European football, I don't know. Incidentally, the director of football at Ajax, Mark Overmars, oh, he was just a club legend who wasn't really qualified for the job. Well, actually, when you look at his post-playing career, He became a major shareholder at a small club in the Netherlands called the Go Ahead Eagles. It's a funny name, I know, but they're serious. He ended up on the supervisory board as a technical director. He came in with a solid football background, but also wanting to learn about how to run a club. He also spent time as a youth coach at Ajax, and eventually he came in and became director of football at Ajax back in June 2012. Do you think that hasn't worked? Of course it's worked. Look at where they are now. Let's give Johan Cruyff some credit for that as well, for creating the base on which the club were able to build. But it's Overmars who's overseen this development, who's overseen the pathway of players, because he spent time after his career understanding how player development works. I don't think Rio has done that, and I think it makes him a very poorly qualified man for the job.
Love Sport.
Now, a man who might also be looking at the end of his career is Alex Hales. He was dropped from the preliminary World Cup squad yesterday. England have insisted it's not the end of his career, but how has this situation been handled? A man who was particularly scathing about the ECB in this morning's Daily Mail was Paul Newman, their cricket correspondent, and he joins me on the line now, Paul. They've got this one wrong, the ECB, haven't they?
Well, they have, James, but what I would say is I think they've reached the right conclusion, but they've perhaps reached it in a rather clumsy way. I do think they've done the right thing in dropping Alex Hales now. I do think he's run out of chances. He's been a serial offender in lots of different ways. This is his second failed drug test for recreational drug use. And I think they have reached the right conclusion. But the way they did it was rather clumsy, to say the least, in that it does look rather like they would never have revealed that Alex Hales had failed a second drug test if the story hadn't become public on Friday, and in which case he would still be in the England squad now, preparing to face Ireland and Dublin on Friday. So from that point of view, yes, they've done it in a rather roundabout way, but I do think it should be pointed out that I do think they've reached the right conclusion.
In terms of, I mean, what a lot of their guidelines say, and let me play devil's advocate for a minute here. They say that they treat recreational drugs as a welfare issue, and that's why the first offence has no ban, the second offence has this relatively short ban. So actually, couldn't you say that it should have been kept in-house, it should have been kept private, and if they don't regard Alex Hales' drug use as really part and parcel of his discipline, then it shouldn't have been reported at all? Why did this story come out?
Well, it is journalism, isn't it? That's our job, to make these things come out. It was Good Friday that Nottinghamshire said that Hales was missing for personal reasons. Now, those of us who have been around the England squad, I won't say smelt a rat, that's a bit harsh, but we did think, hello, is there more to this? Because we know of Alex Hales as someone who can't seemingly keep himself out of trouble. And we did wonder, what is this all about? There had been a report in one newspaper of issues with his girlfriend in the West Indies. We knew he was going through that. And I think the easy conclusion to reach was that it was linked to that. But it did feel immediately as if there was something more to it than that. Myself, along with all my colleagues, as far as I'm aware, would have tried to find out what that was. And Ali Martin of The Guardian, you have to give credit to, because he's the man who broke the story. And that's our job, to do that. We have to try and find out what the real story is here. Now, you know, what the ECB was certainly guilty of was naivety in thinking that it wouldn't come out, because these things invariably do come out. And I think it's an insult to the media to suggest that they can keep it quiet. Now, what I would say is that they have rules that probably tied their hands and made it harder for them to release it, because it is a welfare issue. And you can understand that in the case of the majority of players who might get involved in something like this. And I can fully understand the first failed test not becoming public. But I do think a second strike, and you really should be out. And I don't think someone in Hales' position, while serving a suspended sentence, remember, for his part in the brawl of Bristol that Ben Stokes was involved in, I think it was wrong to try and keep that private. Now, they say that they were their rules that they were abiding by, and confidentiality, etc., etc. But in this case, I think they should have owned the story, got it out there, and explained why they were acting the way they did. Now, when it did become public, I think that brought a whole new sort of attitude towards it. And I think that was the cue almost for Ashley Giles, who is not a man who's going to be messed about. He's going to be, he's warned the players that he's going to take a hard line on anybody that steps out of line. They've had image issues over the past 18 months with Bristol, with a few drinking incidents in Australia. They're desperate to appeal to a younger, new audience, the ECB moving forward. They want young people to be attracted to the game. They don't want bad publicity. So I think once it was in the public domain, it gave Ashley Giles the cue to say, okay, enough's enough now. And he had meetings with Howes himself. He had talks with Trevor Bayliss, with Ed Smith, with Owen Morgan. And I think I'm right in saying that they all agreed enough was enough and this was the right course of action. Now, where you think Howes does have a point is that if he was promised by the ECB that this wouldn't be the course of action, that he did have a future as long as he showed contrition and went along with a rehabilitation programme, then he's got a case. But I'm afraid there won't be too much sympathy for him amongst those who follow the England team closely. And I don't think there'll be too much sympathy for him actually within the team and the management either, because I think they've basically had enough of him, which is a shame because he's a real talent. He wouldn't have been in the starting 11, and that was solely down to Bristol. He would have been in the starting 11, but he lost his place to Jason Roy, and Roy and Bairstow have become the first choice opening pair in the 50-over team. But he would have been a useful member of the squad, and it's a blow. But I think for the sake of unity, for the sake of all sorts of reasons, they had to take this action. And it's just a case of as we've said, and as we featured in the Mail today, how they actually came about it and did they attempt to cover up. But the bottom line being, they've done the right thing.
Look, it's clear that Alex Hales has got it wrong, and he's got it wrong on a number of occasions over the last couple of years. And this is, you know, he's 30, not 20, as he said himself in that interview a month ago, which now looks somewhat ironic about learning the lessons the hardest way. But I'm sort of more fascinated almost by the ECB on this, because you talk about how there's a lot of people probably within the team environment who did not want Hales part of it because of everything that had gone on. But the ECB knew about this ban weeks ago before they named the squad. So what message does it send to the squad if they say, right, we're willing to tolerate this within the team environment if we can keep it quiet? But if it's in the, you know, so you're basically saying to players, yeah, fine, go out and do this, but for goodness sake, don't get caught.
Well, I think that's unfair, to be honest. I don't always jump to the ECB's defence, as you can see from the paper today.
Yeah.
But I do think that's a bit unfair. I do think their hands were tied to an extent by the rules and regulations. Well, as the fact that this is treated by the regulations as a welfare issue rather than a disciplinary one.
So I agree with those rules. Sorry, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Paul, but I just want to clarify. If their hands are tied by those regulations in the first place, do you then think they are able to drop him because the story became public? Or actually, is this going to get them in further hot water?
Well, no. As I've said repeatedly, I think they've reached the right decision, but they might have reached it in a clumsy way. I think that they had, you know, once it was in the public domain, I do think that they've had the right to treat it a bit differently. I do think that it would have been made it even worse if they'd have just bungled along and just sort of said, okay, he's carrying on, but deep down we think we should have acted here. I mean, Ashley Giles has shown himself to take decisive action. He moved on. He demoted Mark Rampakash as the Test batting coach as soon as he arrived, which means he'll miss out on the Ashes this summer. When Paul Farbrace has been an integral member of the management team, said that he wanted to take a new job with Warwickshire, but he could start it after the World Cup. He said, no, let's make the break now. We don't want this hanging over us. When there was the issue of this WhatsApp group among some young players in Worcestershire, which came to light in the court case surrounding the Worcestershire player, whose name escapes me at the moment, who was convicted of rape a few weeks ago.
Oh, Hepburn, yeah.
Hepburn, sorry, Alex Hepburn. There was other players who were involved in what was perceived to be a rather nasty and unpleasant WhatsApp group. Joe Clark and Tom Cole Cadmore, and they were dropped from the Lions party because of that. So Giles has shown himself to be a disciplinarian. That's the way he wants to do the job. He's made it perfectly clear to all the players that he won't accept it. When his hands were tied by confidentiality issues, he had lots of meetings with Howes and they went through the correct procedures.
Yeah.
But I think that was just changed by the fact it became public. They were wrong to think they could keep it private. They should have acted more proactively. And I'm afraid in this instance, you know, the other mistakes that Howes made do have to come into the equation. And I think the right conclusion has been reached.
Yeah.
It's very sad. He's a very good player. If Jason Roy is not fit for the World Cup, then Howes will be missed. But in James Innes, they've got a very good replacement. He's got 190 against Gloucestershire for Hampshire last week.
Yeah.
And he will come into the squad now. So they're still a very strong squad. They're still a very unified squad. It's unfortunate this has happened at the end of a four-year warm-up period for this World Cup. It's been very positive, but it's happened, and they've now got to get on with it. And it is, yes, there are serious questions for the ECB to answer how they've handled it. But I do think by hook or by crook, they've done the right thing.
Yeah, quite. Paul, it's really kind of you to give us so much of your time. I know you're a Spurs fan, so I very quickly want to ask you, how nervous are you about this evening? Are you confident of getting a decent result?
I'm incredibly nervous, and I'm not confident, basically. I'm 53 years old. This is the biggest game in my lifetime. I can't quite believe that we're going to approach it without so many important players and people like Skip and George Marsh could be on the bench with no attacking options on the bench. I do feel that the squad has run out of energy and puff at the wrong time. I'm even still worried about top four place, to be honest. I can't see us beating Bournemouth or Everton, but that's the pessimist in me.
But no one else wants to get into top four either. It's all after you, sir. So it'll be fine.
That's the only thing that's saving us at the moment.
Yeah,
but it's an incredibly exciting prospect. I'm going to get there very early tonight
to poke
it all in. And we pulled off a miracle against Man City somehow, so I'm hoping for the same again.
Sometimes lightning strikes twice. Paul, best of luck tonight. Have a cracking time. I'm sure you will. And thank you very much for your time as well. That's Paul Newman, Daily Mail cricket correspondent, and of course, an extremely nervous Spurs fan. I'm sure there's plenty of those kicking around North London tonight.
Love Sport.
Now, it looks like the wait is over for Anthony Joshua's next opponent. We thought he was going to be fighting Jarrell Miller. He failed a drugs test, and now it looks like Andy Ruiz Jr. will be the man to take on the undefeated unified world heavyweight champion Anthony Joshua in New York on June the 1st. I think most casual boxing fans will have had to Google Andy Ruiz Jr. and they might have found a slightly overweight 6'2" heavyweight. Is that an impressive opponent for Joshua? Let's ask someone who knows. Ron Lewis, a respected boxing journalist, is on the line. Ron, I have to admit, even as someone who knows my way around boxing, I don't know if Andy Ruiz is going to give Joshua much of a challenge, is he?
I don't think he's going to give Joshua much of a challenge. Ruiz sort of came through a few years ago as a bit of a prospect. Known sort of like he's got quite fast hands, but he's always looked terribly out of shape. We went through a sort of period in the 80s and 90s with a lot of heavyweights being sort of like out of shape, but he looks a bit of a throwback in that sense. And I think it's an odd choice. I mean, he's a good talker. He'll bring in an American audience. You know, he's Mexican as well, so there'll be a Mexican sort of background to it as well. They might take an interest in it. But it seems a strange choice of opponent because, for two reasons. One, because the way he looks, he's essentially 4 inches shorter than Joshua, and then generally about a stone and a half heavier than him. And on top of that, his one defeat came against Joseph Parker. And Joseph Parker, of course, lost to Joshua in the unification fight. And he lost virtually every round to Joshua. So the matchup, the sort of like of records, isn't that great either. But I suppose from their point of view, they're looking for an opponent. It's just over a month. It's a month tomorrow till the fight. You go with what you can find.
I thought it was interesting what Eddie Hearn said about him, Joshua's promoter. He says he will entertain you, even if it means getting sensationally knocked out. He will rather do that than not do it. I wonder if that's in the back of their mind as well. He's a guy who's going to come and probably do what he is required to do, which is get knocked out in 6 rounds.
Possibly. I mean, if that is the case, I mean, you think that, you know, you'll naturally think Mexican, you think the guy's going to come and stand in front of you and fight. But, you know, he's a sort of like smart boxer and he went the distance with Parker. And you think he'll be there to be hit by Joshua. Obviously, they want to see him get knocked out, but at the same time, it could not necessarily work like that. He could sort of fiddle his way through, which wouldn't be that great a spectacle.
I mean, I suppose the reality of the situation is that was Jarrell Miller ever going to be much of a better opponent? I think a lot of people looked at him and thought, well, he looks a bit out of shape, even if he is an absolutely massive bloke.
No, I mean, it's the problem is where we've got. There are various problems. One problem is that Joshua hasn't boxed since last September. It's the biggest break of his career. There had originally been talk that after he fought Povetkin last September, he might have a fight in December and he might fight Miller in September, and that would have then been a kind of tick over fight. But then it was like, oh no, they're going to go ahead with Dillian White. Originally, Dillian White was a big step down from Deontay Wilder, who we all hoped would happen. So we went Wilder down to White, then went down to Miller, and now we're sort of like poking around in that kind of level of sort of unproven heavyweights. We're not talking about guys who've won titles. You know, we're not talking in the case of Ruiz as someone who's even beaten a top 10 opponent. And that was the same with Miller. And if you're looking in that sort of category, you know, that's what you're going to get. This is meant to be a sort of like show Joshua off to the American audience type fight. To one extent, it's fair enough. But at the same time, if you're only boxing once every 9 months, that's not that great. You know, most people would say, if he's boxing three times a year, they wouldn't expect all three to be realistically to be blockbuster opponents. But if you are, you know, taking 6 months off between fights or boxing once or twice a year, then you'd want those fights to be big fights. And that's just not the case with this. You know, I haven't seen any odds for the fight yet, but I'll be surprised if Joshua was anything less than 50-1 on to win it.
Yeah.
No one will expect Ruiz to win. And that isn't a great spectacle for the sport of boxing.
But isn't that the reality of the heavyweight division at the moment? It's Joshua Wilder Fury. You could say Dillian Whyte. But then beyond that, is there much depth in the division?
There's a few. I mean, the guy actually White fighting Oscar Rivas is an unbeaten heavyweight. He might be quite good. That might be quite a good fight, White and Rivas.
Mm.
And you know, you'll always get guys who are sort of like reasonably untested coming through who are a bit more of a... The problem is because Ruiz has lost before, and then after he lost to Parker, and there were quite a few people who thought Ruiz deserved to win it, but it was a close fight.
Yeah.
He took 15 months off. So he isn't someone who's gone out and beaten a couple of contenders, then come back and really shown himself. He's a guy who had one big fight and he's sort of been hanging around in the lower reaches of the world rankings. And if there are some decent heavyweights around, look at in Britain, you've got Joe Joyce. You've got the guy who controversially beat Joe Joyce in the heavyweight rankings, Tony Yoka. If they'd have gone for that, you know, you've got Alexander Usyk coming up from Cruiserweight. There are sort of good guys around, but when you have three guys in Fury, Wilder and Joshua who are all looking kind of not to fight each other because of various reasons, then they're sort of taking their picks of sort of tick over fight.
Yeah.
So presumably building towards a fight between them eventually, but you know, we all want to see those fights. We all want to see the fights between the best guys, and then you hope that other top fighters emerge who are sort of like worthy contenders. But at the moment, Fury's fighting Tom Schwartz, who's really unproven.
Mm.
Then you've got Wilder's fighting Dominic Brazil, who was stopped by Joshua already. And they're just not good fights happening.
Just finally, Ron, I have to get your thoughts on the ban that's been handed down for Jarrell Miller today. A six-month ban for a bloke who... I mean, it wasn't just one failed drugs test. It was a series of them, and they were proper performance-enhancing drugs. I mean, how damning is this on boxing's attitude to performance-enhancing drugs at the moment?
It's completely damning on boxing's attitude. I mean, to be clear, the only ban that's been mentioned so far is by the WBA, and all they've done is banned them from their rankings for 6 months.
Right.
But it's a horrendous move. I mean, it's an indication. Boxing suffers as many governing bodies. Essentially, WBA aren't a licensing body, so it'll have to go somewhere and get a license. And that might not prove too easy. But then there are 50 different states in America. That means 51 if you include Washington, D.C., different commissions. And
someone will give him a license.
And once he gives him a license, if all governing bodies are happy to rank him, he can get a title fight. There'll be a promoter willing to put him on. And the danger is, obviously, in boxing, that you're going to get a guy who's making these sort of heavy-duty drugs that Miller was taking. This isn't some sort of like thing that Billy Joe Saunders got going for, which was a sort of like a cold relief. These are heavy-duty human growth hormone, things like that.
Mm.
And of course, the danger, everyone knows the danger is someone could end up getting killed. Someone could end up being seriously damaged because that's the nature of boxing.
Mm.
You know, if the people in boxing pretend to care about the sport, then they've got to do something about it and they've got to make a stand. And the WBA, they're incapable of making that sort of stand.
You're quite right, Ron. Couldn't agree more. Thanks so much for your insight there. Great to have someone who knows what they're talking about. That's Ron Lewis, boxing journalist on the line, talking about Anthony Joshua and, frankly, boxing's disgraceful attitude to performance-enhancing drugs. You have to be firm on these things, and boxing has been far from that.
Love Sport. You must to show respect for the competition, and you must to show respect for the opponent, because it's going to be tough. I think it's going to be so tough. Ajax is fully deserved to be where they are, and of course it's going to be a very competitive game.
Mauricio Pochettino there talking up his side's clash with Ajax tonight. It is going to be a difficult game for Tottenham. We've seen what Ajax can do away from home this season. They show no fear against the likes of Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, Juventus. They are a side who fear absolutely nothing. I think the biggest thing that Tottenham are going to have to deal with is that midfield. The likes of De Beek, De Jong, they provide very good links between defence and attack. While Ajax do play passing football, it's not slow passing football, it is quite direct. They move the ball quickly, and once the ball gets into the likes of Dusan Tadic, you don't want him to have space. Now, how do you prevent that? Do you go and press the ball and stop it getting there at all? Perhaps, but the problem that Ajax pose then is they have ball players all over the park, whether it's the centre halves or whether it's the fullbacks. If you give them space, they're going to start running with the ball. I think it's a really interesting tactical occasion for Mauricio Pochettino tonight, taking on a talented Ajax team with a strong system that sticks to their shape. You very rarely find them out of shape. And that's, I think, the key. For Tottenham, we know that they'll work hard. We know they'll provide plenty. But, you know, there's no Heung-min Son tonight, for example. That's a big loss. He's a guy whose energy is hard to replace, whose attacking threat and goal-scoring threat with both feet is extremely hard to replace. So I do think that they need to look at how they can deal with not having Heung-min Son, because I don't think you can replace him. I really don't. I don't think he is replaceable per se. So I think they now need to think about a different game plan. Christian Eriksen will cover a lot of ground, we know that. Dele Alli will cover a decent amount of ground too. But are they going to make up for the lack of Son? I don't know. Well, let's see what Ajax are expecting and get a little bit of a Dutch perspective on things with James Rowe, Dutch football journalist, who joins me on the line now. James, just how exciting is it to have a Dutch team in the Champions League semi-finals again?
Good afternoon, James. Thanks for having me on. Yes, it's very exciting. Amsterdam is extremely excited. The whole city's very proud of the achievements of the Ajax team this year, especially in Europe. And everybody believes that this adventure is not over yet.
Have you seen this coming? You know, we know a lot has been written and said about the likes of, you know, Mark Overmars, Johan Cruyff, what he did for the club. And has it been a case of when, not if, for Ajax?
Well, you can see back in 2017 when they reached the Europa League final, there were signs of something special coming. But it's just been the team has been strengthened with players, more experienced players such as Daley Blind and Dusan Tadic, which has added a new dimension to them and given them even more belief. You know, and for them to be led by a 19-year-old captain in Matthijs de Ligt, who's a once-in-a-generation player. You know, this is a journey that started out for everybody at the back end of last July at home to Sturm Graz in the qualifiers, and they had to continue against Standard Liège and then Dynamo Kiev just to reach the group stage. And they're now with a fantastic opportunity to reach the Champions League final for the first time since 1995.
I can scarcely believe that Matthijs de Ligt is 19 years old, because he's an amazing leader, an amazing player. Is there any chance that Ajax are going to hang on to him after this amazing run?
Well, it's unlikely, but it all depends on the club that comes in for him. You know, he's extremely intelligent. You know, he's wiser than his years. I mean, I've often stated on many different podcasts, and also it being in the position to interview professional players and managers, you know, when you listen to him speak, you wouldn't think here is a young player of 19 years of age. You know, in the way he describes post-match incidents or respects fellow opponents. For me, it's about who comes in for him, because I think he's smart enough. He's not just a tremendous footballer, but he's also smart enough to assess all his options. And I can't see him moving just for the sake of it. You know, it's very important for him that he continues to play every game, every minute of every game. And he also respects the fact that he's in a position at the age of 19 to captain the biggest club in the country and the responsibility that brings with it.
Do you think it would make a difference? Let's say, I mean, let's just say Ajax win the Champions League. Do you think it would make a difference to, I mean, we know Frankie de Jong is already gone, but do you think it would make a difference to that squad where the club hierarchy might be able to say, look, we do have a little bit more money now. We can offer you a little bit more on the side, and therefore there's more incentive for them to stay? Or actually, is this an opportunity for Ajax they have to take now because it's not going to come again?
Yeah, they have to take it now, especially in terms of playing in the Champions League. Yes, it was an opportunity and a fantastic story to reach the Europa League final, but in particular with the Champions League, with the budgets that some teams have in particular to strengthen over the summer, this is an opportunity they have to take with both hands. And also for these young players as well, they've still got an awful long way to go in their careers. And, you know, when they look back, when they're retired, which it seems light years away from now, but this is going to be something they took out of. Did they take the most out of it? Did they do everything they can that they could to reach the final? I think with the second leg, particularly in Amsterdam, I think with the home crowd behind them, I think this adventure's not over yet.
The line's breaking up a little bit, James. We'll try and persist. Hopefully, it'll get a little bit better. The tactical matchup tonight, I've again read lots of things because just about every national newspaper in England has been putting together a dossier on how Ajax play. What I haven't seen is how to beat Ajax. If there is a way, what do you think it is?
I think it's absolute lightning speed and pace. A complete light and complete pace in terms of ball circulation, in terms of being innovative, in terms of being quick free kicks. You know, they are a team that often can counter-attack, but if, like, for example, if you look at the ability that Liverpool have with their lightning quick counter-attacks at the speed of light, you know, that is something which could unlock them. But I think Tottenham as well, you know, with an experienced goalkeeper in Hugo Lloris, I think he's going to have his work cut out over the two legs, particularly in the second leg in Amsterdam. But Ajax have managed to score in all but one of their Champions League away games this year. That was away in the playoff round to Dynamo Kiev. And they are highly confident of scoring in London tonight.
How are the Dutch media seeing it in terms of where Ajax are? Are they seeing it? They expect Ajax to make it through against Tottenham? Because you must think, compared to Liverpool or Barcelona, it's a good draw for them.
I think that what the Dutch media, first and foremost, they're very proud because it wasn't so long ago that when, after failure for the Dutch national team of qualifying for major tournaments, it wasn't so long ago that the ethos of Dutch football was being questioned. Mm. And you saw about, you know, a root and branch after a failure to qualify for the World Cup and Euro 2016. And here we have the biggest club in the country exercising their ethos in giving young players an opportunity. First and foremost, the media are very proud, but I think the media are also making it quite clear that the role is a little bit different for Ajax, where they could be, in some cases, viewed as the favourite in the tie this evening and over the two legs.
Just finally, James, from your own perspective, what's your prediction for the score tonight? How do you see it unfolding?
My prediction is 1-1. I think that this tie will be won in Amsterdam in the second leg. I think with the home advantage, I think if the first leg was in Amsterdam and the second leg was in London, I think the dynamic would be completely different. But I just think this team has come so far now, and it's a tremendous achievement. You know, it wasn't so long ago that in the media here and in some outlets it was questioning if the Dutch team would ever reach the latter stages of the Champions League ever again. And now you're seeing that is the case in the setting tonight. So I think it's going to be a real... I think the first game is going to be very much chess-like, I think, where Ajax will wait and see and try to pounce. But I think the tie tonight, my team's 1-1, and I believe that Ajax will go through with a victory in the second leg in Amsterdam.
I'm sure it'll be brilliant finding out. James, thank you so much for your expert insight there. That's James Lowe, football journalist covering Dutch football.
Love sport.
I want to talk about Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Because Zlatan has a bit of an ego. In other news, the Pope's quite keen on God, Tiger Woods is rather good at golf, and Tommy Robinson can be a bit controversial at times. It's often been said to me that Zlatan is actually, by the way, a relatively normal bloke. A relatively normal bloke, apparently, with a sense of humour, and that this, like, super egotistical persona is actually some sort of pretty high-level, highbrow comedy act. Seriously, people say this to me, like quite a lot of people claim that Zlatan Ibrahimovic is basically putting on a character, as if one day he's going to pull off the mask and reveal himself to be Sacha Baron Cohen's greatest ever ruse. This isn't Borat, this is Zlatan, actual Zlatan Ibrahimovic, not pretending to be a complete... There's so many words to describe him, I can't say half of them. But it's not Zlatan pretending to be Zlatan, this is who he is. He really is that much of a maniac. And if you needed further proof, former QPR defender Nedim Manua was kind enough to provide Love Sport with a bit more yesterday after an on and off field altercation with Ibrahimovic. For context, Ibrahimovic had grabbed Manua during the game, thrown him to the floor by the neck. It ended in a little bit of a clash. And then finally, Ibra scored the winner for LA Galaxy. They beat Real Salt Lake 2-1, and he celebrated in Anua's face. Needless to say, it didn't leave him happy, and it didn't stop there.
Going to the dressing room after the game, my team's disappointed because we've just lost, and I'm annoyed because of the way that the guy was carrying himself. And then he walks into the dressing room. First things first, never in all my games that I've played has an opponent's player walked into a dressing room 5 minutes after a game's finished. So I'm thinking, what's going on here? And he's saying to me, he said, have you calmed down now, big man? Have you calmed down now? And I'm looking at him. It's a real surreal moment. Like, why is one of their team here? Why is a guy who I've just been battling with coming towards me? Why is he saying this? So I said, no, I've not calmed down. And I said, if you think it's all right to say the stuff that you said to me on that field there, then you're wrong. As far as I'm concerned, you can... obviously I can't swear on radio, but I basically told him to get lost. Yeah, and I proceeded to say over and over and over because I didn't like the audacity to think that he can just get away with saying and doing whatever he wants, and then afterwards he's going to come to me and I'm going to shake his hand. Because I will shake people's hands that I respect from the way that they play the game, and the way that he's played the game wasn't right. It's not the way that I would ever teach my kids to play. It's not the way I'd ever encourage anybody else to play.
Nedim Manua there, a man who you may remember from playing for QPR and Man City in the UK, now plies his trade at Real Salt Lake. He works hard, he does his job, he's a defender, he's an uncompromising one, but he says that he doesn't cross the line. He doesn't want to be that person who crosses the line and goes out to injure people. Zlatan Ibrahimovic appears to be that man. So why do people love him so much? I cannot understand why people are so obsessed with this guy who's so clearly such a problematic person. Anua says he only heard the things that Ibrahimovic was saying to him two or three times in his career, and then from complete and utter thugs. Do people really admire the utter arrogance of this man? Football, I think, is about role models, to a certain extent. It's not all about role models, but it does throw up quite a few of them. And one of the reasons it's so popular is that you can come from nowhere, from nothing. You can be the poorest man in your village, and you can become one of the biggest stars in the world. It's an equaliser. It's a leveller. Sure, there are still inequities, but it is like a lot of sports. It's something of a leveller. And it preaches a bit of humility because of that. Because it can push you up high and it can dash you down low as well. And it takes people who have no hope to areas of hope. Even those standing on the terraces are people who go there looking for some sort of hope, for some sort of joy. And I know that's a little bit romantic, but that is the ideal of football. So I can't really understand why people look at Zlatan and think that's the person I want to represent my sport. Nedim said it himself there, I wouldn't teach my kids or anybody else to play the game that way. I'd be staggered if anyone looks at Zlatan and thinks he's a role model. It's scarcely credible that someone like Zlatan actually exists. Although, I suppose, in a country where Donald Trump is president, it should not be surprising that such a grotesquely large ego is flourishing. And that's the comical factor in all of this, is that with the greatest respect to MLS, and I think MLS has made a lot of progress, but it's not a top 10 global league. You know, it's not in that kind of echelon. Ibrahimovic is trying to convince us that his goal-scoring exploits there are legitimately impressive. This is a league where Bradley Wright Phillips is a Hall of Famer. This is not a brilliant league. It's great on a lot of things. It does some really good work. And there are a few good players playing there, let's be fair. But it's not the Champions League, although Ibrahimovic's relationship with that particular competition also leaves something to be desired. And for all that Ibrahimovic's 30 goals in 34 games looks all right on paper, we all know the truth, Zlatan. we all know that you're basically past it. You've been put out to stud in America, and that's what you're doing. Strutting around, trying to show off in a field where, realistically, you are the biggest stallion because you've been put there based on your previous successes. It's not impressive. And Anua is merely reminding us that Zlatan is in a league where people will fawn over him. They will fall over themselves to shake his hand afterwards just for the privilege of sharing a picture with him. And I applaud Nadim for refusing to do so because he doesn't think Ibrahimovic deserved it. He said that Ibrahimovic would have been a laughingstock after that game if he hadn't scored that late goal because he played that poorly. And running around the pitch, threatening to injure someone, that's what Zlatan was doing for the last half hour of the game. Every time he was near Anuri, he said, "I'm going to do you. I'm going to do you before this game's over." That's not what football's about. It's about mutual respect. Sure, it's important to be competitive, to be physical, to push the boundaries, but also to show mutual respect for your fellow professional. Zlatan has never shown any of that. He's only ever shown contempt for the majority of his fellow professionals throughout his career. Maybe it's time for us, as media, as fans, to see how he likes it. We should turn it on him and see how he feels when he starts getting the same treatment he gives everyone else.
Love Sport.
And I want to talk a little bit more about this Alex Hales story, which of course broke over the week before the weekend, that he was serving a 21-day ban for a second recreational drugs test. A second failed recreational drugs test, I should say. The way it works in cricket, the first one, you get no punishment. You're offered treatment, and it's very much kept in-house. The second one, they tried to keep that in-house as well. It was all too good to be true, really, in terms of cricket. English cricket was just starting to look good. England were the best side in the world, the best one-day side in the world anyway, playing a fearless and exciting, aggressive brand of cricket and peaking just in time for a home World Cup. Even the weather was starting to get nice. And then it clouded over and it got very windy and very cold. And England took careful aim and shot itself in both feet. On the one hand, England's most dangerous and crucially versatile batsman had the absolute and chronic lack of common sense to both take and then get caught taking recreational drugs twice. How stupid do you have to be, really? But when you look at the authority who are supposed to be holding him to account, are you surprised? Because the ECB were well aware of the failed test before they named a 15-man preliminary squad for the World Cup, by the way. And they still picked Hales. They knew, and Hales knew that they knew, and they'd all sat around and talked at length about how much they knew and how much it wasn't going to change that Alex Hales would be in the World Cup squad. If Hales' own statement via his management company is to be taken at face value, he had been told it wouldn't be a problem. They said in the statement that he was hugely disappointed at his treatment, that the ECB insisted on Alex taking certain rehabilitation measures following his suspension, and at every stage, Alex fulfilled his obligations, and both he and his representatives were assured that any suspension under ECB's guidelines could not affect his selection for the World Cup. The fact all those assurances seem to have been rendered meaningless has understandably left Alex devastated. Excuse me. He will take time to reflect both on his actions and the subsequent decisions. I'm staggered that there is so much disagreement between the two parties about exactly what should have taken place. In an interview Hales gave a month ago, he talked all about second chances and learning the lessons the incredibly hard way. I tell you what, they are lessons that are hard, but they're a whole lot harder to learn when your teacher demonstrates the kind of double standards that the ECB are showing. It's what we, you know, it's like bad parenting. Do as I say, not as I do. It doesn't help. Children, and frankly, sports people, need consistency when it comes to discipline. They need reliability. They need routine. They're simple people with a lot of work to do, and they don't need to be dealing with authority that changes its mind. And it's not the first time, if you ask me, when you think of the Kevin Peterson debacle, for example, whoever's version of events you believe, that the ECB have tried to deal with things through clandestine meetings in corridors and in quiet rooms that they hope no one would ever hear about, that they hope no one would ever know what went on in them. And as with the Hales cover-up, And that's what it is, by the way. It's a cover-up, because the ECB knew about the drugs ban, they said it wouldn't make a difference, they still picked him, and then when it became public knowledge, they then abandoned him again and dropped him. It's a staggeringly naive, and Paul Newman said it earlier, it's a staggeringly naive way of dealing with things on behalf of the ECB. How on earth they thought they could double-cross, and that's what this is, they've double-crossed one of their own, never mind cover up a drugs ban, during the biggest summer for English cricket in a generation. It beggars belief. Hales is an idiot, clearly. You'd have to be an idiot to get caught for recreational drugs once, get away with it, because that's what the regulations say, and then do it again, in what is such a massive summer. But he doesn't have much of an example to follow, does he? England's collapse usually comes when they're at the crease. In this case, they've tripped over their own shoelaces walking out of the dressing room, and I, for one, am ashamed.
Love Sport.
Now, if you are anywhere in London at the moment, you cannot escape the fact that Tottenham are taking on Ajax in what is one of the club's biggest games in their history tonight. It's also a game with a very strong Jewish connection, because while you may know that Tottenham have long been associated with the Jewish people in the UK, Ajax are known as a big Jewish club as well. But why and how? Let's talk to someone who knows all about this. Anthony Klavan is on the line. He's a university lecturer. He's also the author of Does Your Rabbi Know You're Here?, The Promised Land, Moving the Goalposts, and most recently, A Yorkshire Tragedy. Anthony, I wonder if you could maybe give us the lay of the land on this, because, as I say, while people do know that Spurs have this Jewish connection, how have Ajax ended up being known as the Super Jews, as I believe they are?
Well, Ajax, like Tottenham, were in the past anyway, based in a sort of Jewish area in Amsterdam, the Jewish quarter, and the old stadium was based there. So there's the similarity with White Hart Lane. The old football ground was based in a sort of big Jewish area in North London. So there is the first connection. And then the other thing is really that, like Tottenham, Ajax have had a number of Jewish players, and they've actually had some managers and also owners. So those are the two really big things that connect Ajax to the Jewish community.
But I understand that the football club these days, you know, a little bit like Tottenham in some ways, I understand that the figures of about 5% of people who regularly go to Tottenham games who are actually Jewish, and I understand at Ajax it might be even lower. Is it strange to you that they've retained these identities then?
Well, yes, because now, as you've rightly pointed out, today both clubs, the majority of their fans are not Jewish, but it's just a sort of tiny number. And it is strange, but I suppose it's about having a connection to your club's history. I mean, you could argue that, you know, with football clubs that have been founded in this country by the church or something, I mean, there's this connection with Christianity. It's the way that the club has developed over the years. I mean, Tottenham remembers that in the 1930s, you know, about a third of their fans, it was estimated, 10,000 out of 30,000 were Jewish. And then with Ajax as well, there's this very strong link to the fact that the terrible tragedy of the Holocaust, where, you know, most of the Jews in the Netherlands or Holland do live in Amsterdam, but you know, during the Second World War, with the Nazi occupation of Holland, of Amsterdam, there was a terrible price to be paid for the Jewish community. So there's this very sort of emotional bond. I mean, one of the Jewish players of Ajax was murdered in a concentration camp by the Nazis. So it's a historical link. It's not a modern day link. And it's very symbolic.
Obviously, the songs and the symbolism used by both clubs do sort of remember that Jewish heritage. But I wonder whether you think tonight, with the two clubs playing each other, both clubs have sometimes tried to... I know Ajax, for example, tried to phase out a number of their different songs and various usages.
Yeah.
Do you think the clubs will celebrate that Jewish connection tonight, or actually they might shy away from it?
That's a very good question, and I'm going to go along and find out.
Well, I just wonder because, you know, for example, we've talked a lot on the station about the Y word, and, you know, one of my best friends is a Tottenham fan. I quite often take up his dad's season ticket when he can't go. I'm not a Tottenham fan, but I've sat in the stands and I've sung those songs, and, you know, I'm not Jewish. It just sort of, everyone's singing, you sing along. And actually now I find myself not singing those songs because I wonder whether using those words gives credence to those who sing it and use it as an offensive term, you know, on the other side. It seems strange to me that even people who aren't Jewish will adopt it as an identity, which then seems to strengthen those who use it as a kind of slur.
Well, you know, I'm glad you do that. I congratulate you. I think you're right to not sing those songs. So it would be a bit like me, who's a white person. If I was supporting a team which, you know, had a big a connection to, you know, the Afro-Caribbean community or had a lot of black players, I mean, I would not identify as, you know, being black, and certainly wouldn't adopt a sort of racist slur. So, you know, and therefore, I think that non-Jewish football fans should respect the fact that Jewish people have not given you permission to co-opt your Jewish identity. So that is why I think there's a negative side to it. But the positive side is that you know, it's all a question about identity and belonging and acceptance. And in both clubs' cases, you know, football has been a way that Jewish communities have come to find acceptance and to feel a sense of belonging over the years as originally sort of immigrants, but, you know, now successfully integrated. And I think to celebrate that sense of identity and belonging and acceptance is a brilliant thing. And I hope tonight that both sets of fans, and I think this will happen, will recognise they've both got something in common, which is a good thing. Why do we always have to focus on the negative side, you know, anti-Semitism? But, you know, let's just be proud of the connection. But there's no need to adopt the Y word. And I don't think there's any need for Ajax either to, you know, sing their songs.
Anthony, thank you so much for that. It's an absolutely fascinating topic. I could talk about it all day. Have a great time tonight. I'm very jealous. I tried tooth and nail to get a ticket for it, but well done. Have a terrific time.
Yeah, thank you.
Brilliant. Thanks. Good to speak to you. That's Anthony Clavan there, a journalist, university lecturer, and also a celebrated author, the likes of Yorkshire Tragedy, Does Your Rabbi Know You're Here, The Promised Land, and Moving the Goalposts, of course.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3 p.m. on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.